the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. 15 years ago, Dr. David Wells wrote a blockbuster of a book. It was entitled No Place for Truth. And in that book, he issued a scathing review of contemporary American evangelicalism. His argument was that we had traded truth for therapy and had accepted such a watered-down understanding of the gospel that we were left with something only barely approximating a church. Now, 15 years later, he's out with a new blockbuster book. It's entitled The Courage to be Protestant. It really is a summary of four previous volumes that he wrote. Involved in a major project, Dr. Wells is trying to set out what he sees as the major challenges for evangelical Christianity in America. And it is a fascinating new book, The Courage to be Protestant. Dr. David Wells, professor of systematic and historical theology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary in Boston, Massachusetts, author of this book. He'll be my guest coming up very shortly for a conversation on the Albert Mohler Program. First, to review some issues in the news. There's a lot of talk right now about energy, and necessarily so, with gas prices now over $4 a gallon in most metropolitan areas. Americans are very interested in energy, and so are the presidential candidates. One of the interesting things to note is that there are many of these candidates who are out suggesting that they know what we should do in terms of energy policy. The reality is that reality is a hard concept. An awful lot of what's going on in terms of this conversation isn't based in reality, but in some kind of ideology or wishful thinking. For instance, there are those who are suggesting that we need to move away from carbon-based fuels to readily available alternatives. The problem is, there are no readily available alternatives. Forbes magazine is out with a very interesting article citing research done by the Heartland Institute, Sterling Burnett. Let me just read to you from what it says. Wind farms produce only a fraction of the energy of conventional power plants while requiring hundreds of times the acreage. Two of the biggest wind farms in Europe have 159 turbines and cover thousands of acres between them, but together take a year to produce less than 4 days output from a single conventional power station. Similarly, a proposed wind farm off the coast of Massachusetts would require 130 towers and more than 24 square miles of ocean. It turns out, by the way, that these giant wind farms do tremendous damage to bird populations because some of the larger birds, and in particular the predatory and migratory birds, tend to go where the wind is because they ride the wind currents. That happens also to be the only place it makes sense to put these wind farms with all of these turbine blades chopping up birds. Now, I'm not an expert in wind energy, and frankly, if it worked, I'd be thrilled that it worked, because like you, I'd be glad to be off of anything that requires me to pay $4 a gallon for fuel. But it doesn't seem plausible to think that we can cover most of North America with wind turbines, and so those who are suggesting that we can instantly get ourselves into a situation of weaning ourselves off of carbon-based fuels appear to not be talking too much about reality. The same thing's true with ethanol and biofuels. It turns out that we may be actually diverting food that someone in the world needs in order to turn it into fuel, in order to try to supplement or to replace gasoline, oil, and other carbon-based fuels. Once again, I'm not speaking as a scientist. I am just suggesting that the reality of our situation is that we've got to figure out how to do with what we have. We've got to figure out how to actually deal with the fact that, at least to this point, nothing in terms of, for instance, automobiles and other vehicles has turned out to be as effective as the carbon-based fuels, oil turned into gasoline. When you hear a lot of these things suggested as alternatives, and when you hear political candidates tossing these things around as if they are the obvious alternatives, you need to ask the question, what would it take to actually get there? What would the country look like if we adopted this? What we need is a very sane and responsible conversation about energy policy. It's going to mean trade-offs. It will mean we're going to have to trade off either some funds through increased prices, or we're going to have to trade off perhaps the size of vehicles or how far we drive. But some kind of trade-off will eventually be necessary, and at least if Europe is the example, one of those trade-offs is going to be that the United States is going to have to look at alternatives that would include something like nuclear power. But right now what we have is a false debate about what is genuinely a very important issue. It also comes to remind us that when you come to debate science in the public square, you better make sure that it actually is science and not scientism. Hazel Muir has written an article in the New Scientist magazine. It's entitled Science Rules, Okay? The question asked under the title is this: why do we still run societies in such a crazy way? Hazel Muir explores the rational alternative. Science is a mode of knowledge and of discovery that is based upon observation and experimentation, documentation, testing, the development of a hypothesis, and then the testing of that hypothesis. Without science, we would not have the cars we drive, the electricity with which we light our homes, and any number of other things that we now take for granted. Scientism is a worldview that says that the only thing that is properly known is known by the means of science. Scientism is a worldview that leads to intellectual disaster, because even though science can tell us a great deal about many, many things, science can't provide the answers to the biggest questions of the meaning of life. Science can't answer morality. Science can't answer the question of human dignity. Science can't answer the question of how we should live our lives. Hazel Muir doesn't seem to understand that. She writes really from a scientism worldview. She says this: in the 21st century, you might expect governments to be pragmatic about achieving their aims, to do what works. This means basing policies on hard evidence rather than on assumptions or ideology. Yet this seldom happens. Even when policies are tested before being rolled out to an entire area or country, the methods used to evaluate their effectiveness are often worse than useless. Well, I decided this was an article that really compelled my attention, and so I wanted to know what her point was. And her point is that science should rule in these questions rather than other modes of knowledge. Well, that gets really interesting, because it turns out she then opposes abstinence-based sex education. She opposes these programs such as Scared Straight to try to encourage young people not to be juvenile delinquents and to end delinquent behavior. You start looking at what you have here, and it really is an ideology. It's not purely based in science, because science itself can't provide some of the assumptions from which she's even working in this article. Worldview analysis is a part of what we have to be about all the time, just reminding ourselves that some things which are obvious end up being obviously false. And it is obviously false to believe that science can answer all the big questions. The San Francisco Chronicle is telling us that young people, speaking in particular here of young adults and teenagers between the ages of 18 and 34, say they are suffering from news fatigue. At a global media conference on Monday, held in Stockholm, Sweden, the context-based research group indicated that news consumption behavior of younger readers differs profoundly from that of previous generations. No surprise there. The research project was commissioned by the Associated Press. It analyzed news consumption patterns of an ethnically diverse group of young adults. Six countries were represented, including the United States, Britain, and India. It turns out that these young adults say they are simply confronted with too much news, too much data, too many voices. A 71-page report out of this is likely to lead to some changes in the news industry, but what it looks like is that young adults are saying there's simply too much. Now, what's really interesting about this is that these same young adults plug in where they want to and tune out where they think there's too much. In my estimation, that really would not be much different generationally than what you would find among their parents and grandparents, who are likely doing the very same thing. If you think it's too much, turn it off. Pick up a book, read, go take a walk, go outside, go to a nursing home and visit someone who needs some companionship. Just complaining that there's too much news seems to me to act like somehow we are somehow prisoners in our own homes, being held at gunpoint in front of a television screen or an internet screen on the computer. That is hardly the case. Speaking of young people, it turns out, according to the Wall Street Journal, that the most stressful year of most adolescents is their junior year in high school. That is the 11th grade in the United States. Why would that be so? It's because that is the year in which most of the big data is being sent in for college applications. Interesting now, many of these young adults respond to the question about their junior year by saying they are in Preparation H, which turns out to mean preparation for the admissions process at Harvard. Generalized to the entire year here of the 16-year-olds who are largely in the 11th grade, it means that they are under enormous pressure SAT scores, the ACT scores, their grade point average, putting together the portfolio that is now necessary, about all their extracurricular activities, trying to make the case that they should be admitted to the local university or to the university or college of their choice. You know, what's really interesting about all this is that when you're talking about 16-year-olds, we now realize we're putting them under enormous pressure, asking them to make decisions about the future. At the same time, we're coddling them as little kids on the other hand. No wonder they're being stressed out. They're not even sure what age their parents think they are. An adult for a few minutes, a little child the next. Somehow, we need to help these kids through what is evidently a very stressful year. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The book is entitled The Courage to be Protestant, Truth Lovers, Marketers, and Emergence in the Postmodern World. The author is David F. Wells. He is the Andrew Mutch Distinguished Professor of Historical and Systematic Theology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary near Boston. He is also one of the leading public intellectuals among American evangelicals, and it is an honor today to have Dr. David Wells as our guest on the Albert Mohler Program. Dr. Wells, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to be on.
Well, your book is one of those books published this year that simply demands evangelical attention, and there are few of those. And I meant exactly what I said in introducing you. You are one of the leading public intellectuals among American evangelicals, and you are willing to take on the big ideas. And one of the things I appreciate about The Courage to be Protestant, your most recent book, is that it takes on some of the most important of those big ideas. How did you come up with the book, and what were you trying to accomplish in this one volume?
Well, I was really trying to respond to the people who said my other books were inaccessible. And they further complained, some of them, that they were put off by footnotes. So I thought, well, I will try to make some of the things I've been talking about for the last 15 years a little bit more accessible. So this last volume, The Courage to be Protestant, is a kind of one-volume summary of the four previous books which I have written. That's how it started out, but all books, as you know, develop a little life of their own. And so once I started working on this and turning it over in my mind, this thesis began to emerge in my mind, and I saw it as really as picking up on the five major themes that I had covered in my four previous books. The thesis is that it takes courage to be Protestant. Not, of course, that we in the West have to pay any price by joining a Protestant denomination. There is no price for us in the West. There is a price for some people in some parts of the world if they join a Protestant denomination, but not for us. The price that we have to pay, and where it is required that we have some courage, is if we are going to live by the truths that have defined Protestantism at its best and highest moments. That's what takes courage. And it takes courage because these truths have to be affirmed both against our postmodern culture and increasingly against the evangelical world or within the evangelical world.
Well, that's why your book is, frankly, a brave book. Let me ask you, when you talk about the lay of the evangelical land, let's just put it bluntly, the great challenge that evangelicalism now represents, what would you have us to see?
Well, I think that this great evangelical coalition, of which I have been a part and which has nourished me all of my teaching life, this great coalition that began after the Second World War here in the United States is falling apart. And it is dividing, as far as I can see, into on the one side, the remnants of this classical evangelicalism. Then from 1975 onwards, in a second constituency, the marketing church following Willow Creek. And then from the 1990s onwards, the emergents, who are in reaction both to classical evangelicals in some ways and in reaction to the marketing church in other ways. So there are now, as I see it, three rather clear differentiated constituencies.
Now, Dr. Wells, in your book, you really go back to the founding of evangelicalism, and that's where I see many of the problems, and I've written about this myself, and you raise two issues. You say really it were weaknesses from the very beginning. You use the words, number one, doctrine shrinks, and then two, the church vanishes. Now, is that where evangelicalism was, in some sense, a failed experiment from the beginning?
Well, that's you're asking a very difficult question, but I think the answer on the doctrine is that the early post-war evangelicals, and I'm thinking about people like Carl Henry, Martin Lloyd-Jones, John Stott, Francis Schaeffer, that generation of leaders understood that biblical Christianity is doctrinal in its shape, and that we cannot do justice to the great truths of historic Christianity unless we state those truths in doctrinal form. What they agreed to do, however, was to draw a line between the things in which they felt they had to be united and those things in which they believed they would give each other room for difference. Now, what happened over time, of course, is that the non-central things began to fade, and then, as we come into the 1990s, say, the things that are right at the center begin to disintegrate. So that now we have a kind of evangelical Christianity that increasingly is non-doctrinal in its shape.
And you also have an evangelicalism that is not very churchly in terms of the primary sense of identity being to the people of God through a local church. You really have the emergence of the kind of do-it-yourself evangelicalism and parachurch evangelicalism that has not worn well over time.
I think that's exactly right. You know, in the early post-war years, the parachurch movements and organizations, I think, really did understand themselves as picking up on a small part of what the church couldn't do or couldn't do well or hadn't done well, but they didn't see themselves as an alternative to the church. But what we notice, of course, in through the 1970s and 80s, when a majority of the evangelical organizations were formed in America, that these organizations increasingly took the place of the church, so that the local church increasingly became a sort of para in its nature, and now, following Willow Creek, don't want to even appear to look like a church. So pews and crosses and Bibles and hymn books have all been tossed out.
We're living in a world in which evangelicalism is really up for grabs. And furthermore, we're living in a world in which many of the central beliefs that have defined evangelicals are now also up for question. The question is, what's the future of evangelicalism if we're not even sure what it means to be an evangelical? My conversations with Dr. David Wells of Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, author of the new book, The Courage to be Protestant. And we'll be right back with this conversation.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest today is Dr. David Wells, author of the book, The Courage to Be Protestant. Back in 1993, 15 years ago, Dr. Wells wrote and published his book, No Place for Truth, or Whatever Happened to Evangelical Theology. And in my view, that book is so important, it would have been worthwhile for Dr. Wells to have spent a life teaching just to have written that book. But it was followed by three others, God in the Wasteland, Losing Our Virtue, and Above All Earthly Powers, all of them really following out the same project of considering the place of evangelical theology and evangelical Christianity in our postmodern world. Now, a one-volume summary that's actually more than that. The book is The Courage to Be Protestant, Truth Lovers, Marketers, and Emergence in the Postmodern World. Dr. Wells, I want to go at the middle category there for just a moment. How threatening is the mentality of marketing to the integrity of evangelical Christianity?
I think we are greatly helped in answering that question by Bill Hybels' own amazing admission that the whole marketing enterprise, as far as Willow Creek is concerned, plus five other churches which he researched, has seriously backfired. Because what he has discovered, and what some of us have been saying all along, is that there is inherent in the marketing mentality a methodology which is destructive to biblical Christianity, because the gospel is not a product, and sinners are not consumers, and God cannot be advertised as something simply to help our inner stresses and therapeutic needs. The moment we go down that road, we may acquire a big following and build a big megachurch, but as Bill Hybels' own internal research shows, it just doesn't amount to anything.
Now, when you start looking at the marketing mentality, the reality is that it's really an infection spread throughout much of the evangelical movement. I know it's one of the three major components of your understanding of today's evangelical structure, but it really infects even beyond those who say they're really given over to marketing.
Well, about 10 years ago, 80% of evangelical pastors said in small or large ways that they had been influenced by Willow Creek. And, you know, I do understand the lure of it. When you are a pastor and you see another pastor down the road suddenly booming because they are following these marketing techniques, it's very tempting to think that one ought to get on the bandwagon as well. But, you know, the real tip-off here that there is something wrong is that both Catholic and liberal Protestant churches, and in fact even a New Age church, so-called church, of which I am aware, have all employed the same techniques and found considerable success. Now, what this tells you is that you can apply these marketing techniques and have a lot of success with very little truth.
And in many senses, that defines what some people think of as evangelical Christianity. But you've been about the project of recovering truth. If you were to point to what evangelicals could do, what evangelical churches, let's be very specific, not evangelicalism as an amorphous structure, but evangelical churches, evangelical pastors, what could an evangelical pastor do to run against the tide and to actually take a stand for truth?
Well, I don't think it's as complex as some people have made out. You know, I travel quite a lot. I go to Africa every year. And in fact, just this last week, I returned after a couple of weeks in China, talking to the Christians who are under really quite severe repression there. as they are in parts of Africa as well. I think it's really quite simple. And it's a two-step process. One, we've got to take seriously the truth God has given us in His Word. And two, we've got to start taking seriously the world around us, understanding it, which in the West is a highly modernized and postmodern world.
We need to continue that in just a moment. We come back from this break. This is really where we need to direct our thinking. How can we redirect evangelicalism? And what is the hope for that redirection in the future? We'll be right back with the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. It took courage in 1993 for Dr. David Wells to write his book, No Place for Truth. That was a book that really did make waves and continues to do so. And now the next volume in his series, after writing four previous volumes, is The Courage to be Protestant. And frankly, it took courage to write this book as well. Dr. Wells, when we're talking about how evangelical Christians should pray and hope to see evangelical Christianity recover the truth, what would you have, for instance, the local pastor to do?
Well, I think these two steps that I mentioned, taking seriously the truth God's given us in the Scriptures, and taking more seriously the world around us are really the key. It's like breathing out and breathing in. The point about the truth that we have in Scripture is that it corresponds to what's in reality. This is not simply about learning a Bible verse, although that is a good thing to do. But we've got to understand that this is real. We're talking about what is in the character of God and what's in the character of human beings and what life is about. Christianity is not simply a technique or a therapy. This is real stuff. On the other hand, we've got to understand the world around us. And if I could point to what I think is a prevailing weakness in our churches, It is right here. It takes a lot of time and thought and work to know how exactly, if you are a pastor, to apply the truth of a biblical passage to our world. You can get that truth, if you are a biblical preacher, fairly quickly by looking at commentaries. But applying it is another matter, and that's, I think, a besetting weakness in the evangelical world. If I were to be asked, would I prefer to hear a topical sermon on how to get on with your mother-in-law, or to hear a sermon on a biblical text which wasn't applied, of course I'd prefer to hear the text preached. But I'd most of all like to know how that text applies. And that is where I think our preachers are weakest, and many people who are reading their Bibles day by day don't see the connections. They therefore come to think of Christianity as a sort of private comfort to them. But they don't understand that we are in a worldview conflict. And the day they step out of their houses, onto the train, into their car, into the workplace, they are in conflict with other worldviews, whether they know it or not.
Dr. Wells, I want to ask a follow-up question to that, because even as I began asking by the focus about the pulpit, let me shift metaphorically here to the pew. You write on page 140 of your book, The Courage to be Protestant, "The truth is that, as the 21st century begins, we have all become adept at being our own healers and our own counselors, dispensing wisdom and comfort to ourselves." Isn't a part of the problem here that many of the people sitting in the pews of evangelical churches really don't think as Christians in the first place, and what many of them are looking for is actually how to get along with their mother-in-law instead of what would the one true and living God expect of me?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. There are two points here. The one is And many people don't understand this, that living in a highly modernized society like ours is, in its postmodern mood, is extremely difficult. You know, this is the American paradox. Never have we had so much, never have we had so many opportunities, but at the same time, never have we had so little. The levels of stress and anxiety have literally never been higher. The incidence of depression has literally never been greater. And we are raising a generation of kids who have never been more demoralized. It is extremely difficult to live in this society. And people come into church with these worries and pressures and anxieties on their mind, and they just want some help, some comfort, some balm, some healing for those things. But the other side, which you mentioned, is just as true. We now are reaping the harvest from not having been preaching expository sermons. So people come into the pews uninstructed, but at the same time yearning for some internal help and comfort, because this is a brutal world. And that combination of really sometimes infantile understanding of biblical truth, but the serious pressures of competing and living in this modern world, that combination has proved lethal to biblical Christianity.
So we have a problem really at both ends of the equation in terms of many preachers, pastors feeling like they have to keep up with a marketing mentality in order to keep up with even the expectations of their own churches, much less of their peers. And then you have people in the pews who want messages that are primarily addressed to themselves as autonomous individuals. Many people are looking for therapy rather than theology or truth in the first place.
That's exactly right.
So do you have much hope about the future of evangelical Christianity in America?
Well, you know, I actually do. I think in the last 5, 6, 7 years, I have seen something coming along in 20-year-olds, 20s and 30s and 40s. This is a group of younger people who have been marketed to until they are sick. So they don't want Willow Creek marketing faith. And at the same time, I think their eyes are wide open to what this postmodern culture does. They are just not enamored with technologically snazzy screens and all of that sort of stuff. They actually want the real thing.
That is a sign of hope, I must say. That is a sign of hope. I'm reminded of what the former British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli said during the Victorian era when speaking of a political initiative. He said, maybe, after trying everything we can conceive that does not work, we will try the one thing that does. My guest today has been Professor David F. Wells of Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, author of the book, The Courage to be Protestant. It in itself is a courageous book. I commend it to you. Dr. Wells, thank you today for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
We'll be right back with closing thoughts, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. I'm glad to have that conversation with Dr. David Wells. He raises some of the most important issues facing evangelical Christians in this generation. He does a couple of things simultaneously that I think we really ought to note. Number one, he does understand the times. This is a man who's given himself for years to understanding what we're really up against in terms of being faithful Christians in this generation. He understands the rise of such things as the sense of the imperial self, with the average American thinking that he or she defines meaning on his or her own terms. You know, that's a very different situation than what Americans would have faced even just 20 or 30 years ago. Looking at the way Americans think about time, think about truth, those are big questions. They really do impact the way we talk about Christ, the way we share the gospel, the way we contend for biblical truth in a postmodern age. But even as he understands the times, what's more important is that even before that, he understands the importance of truth. He understands the importance of the Christian gospel. He understands that the question of God is the most important question that the human mind can ever conceive. Thus, what he really does is to help us to understand that what people in this generation want as a default position is a God who tells them that they really are the imperial self. A God who comes to help them in terms of therapy but doesn't make demands on them in terms of truth. A God who brings them self-fulfillment and self-esteem but would never judge them for their sins, would never want them to feel guilty. Now, it's one thing to understand that there are people in this culture who really are shaped that way in terms of their expectation. It's another thing for the church to say we can meet them at that expectation. That's where I think that the work of David Wells really does require courage. And that's why his book, The Courage to Be Protestant, really is an important book. When he talks about truth seekers and marketers and emergence, he's really talking about three different options here. And there are some who would like to see the evangelical movement to just continue along the road of marketing. But as he makes very clear, the gospel isn't something that really can be marketed. When he looks at the emergent church, he's looking at how we respond to the postmodern era, and he's suggesting that there are severe limitations to just how postmodern we can be, even in trying to reach postmodernists. In the end, those who love the truth are those who will remain with the gospel. We have a lot to learn from the world around us. We have a lot to learn from those who are trying to reach the world around us. But in the bottom line analysis, we've got to hold fast to the gospel. Knowing what the truth is, knowing who God is, knowing what the Bible is, knowing what the church is, those are the essential ingredients, at least for a start, in understanding what evangelical Christianity is to be. Let's not fool ourselves. We're living in a world of constant temptations to keep Christians from being faithfully Christian. It really does help to have someone with his kind of sensitivity, like Dr. David Wells, to look at these questions and help us to think the issues through. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. We're going to be asking this question. What exactly should we be looking for in a president or in the presidency? I'll meet you tomorrow. This is Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.